This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa huwal لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما في الأرض من لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء ولا يؤوده حفظهما وهو العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The UN General Assembly passes resolutions affirming sovereignty of Syria and the Golan Heights, as well as the right of Palestinians to self-determination. Officials in the U.S. state of Georgia say a hand audit of ballots cast in the presidential race confirms Joe Biden's victory in the battleground state. Also coming up, the coronavirus pandemic is surging in the United States as authorities report more than 2,200 new deaths and over 200,000 new cases. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, the United Nations General Assembly has approved several resolutions against Israel. The Assembly passed a draft proposal affirming permanent sovereignty of Syrians in the occupied Golan Heights. That happened despite opposition from Israel and the US. The General Assembly also passed two resolutions affirming the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination and sovereignty over their land. Palestine's Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki hailed the UN measure. He said the overwhelming vote was a natural response from the international community to the Israeli occupation. Maliki called on UN members to shoulder their responsibilities to protect the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people. He also called for practical measures in the face of Israeli violations. Richard Silverstein is a journalist and political commentator, and he joins us now. Richard, welcome. Regarding the resolution over the Syrian occupied Golan Heights, they're reaffirming the UN Assembly that it belongs to Syria. It's kind of a smack in the face for the United States and Israel.
Well, they're basically reaffirming international law, so they're not telling us anything new, but they are. It is a slap in the face to Mike Pompeo, who was in the Golan up to a few hours ago, or maybe a half a day ago, visiting the Golan for the first time any U.S. Secretary of State has ever visited the occupied territories or the Golan. So it's a very clear response saying that the world community rejects this American claim. It rejects the Israeli claim that its occupation is legitimate and justifiable under international law. So it's a restatement of what is obvious to most of the world except for Trump and Netanyahu.
And then the other part of this is the resolutions in support of the Palestinians' right to self-determination. Now, when it comes to self-determination, there's an argument there to be made that it covers all occupied Palestine.
Well, I think that I don't, you know, we can parse different ways of interpreting that, but I think that it also is restating the rights of the Palestinian people to either create their own state if they decide to do that, or if Israel continues to reject the idea of a Palestinian state, then creating a single state that would combine Israelis and Palestinians into a single state. And many of us, like me, who used to be a liberal Zionist at one time, supported a two-state solution, but that seems no longer viable, and it's why many of us have come to believe that one-state solution is the only one that is viable. But the affirmation of the Palestinian rights in that resolution, of course, is, again, a reaffirmation of what we all know, those of us who believe in international law, to be true. And it's a slap in the face of the delusion of the Israelis and the Americans that they're going to single-handedly be able to redefine what international law is on this.
On the international community to shoulder and protect the Palestinians' inalienable right to for the Palestinians in this regard. Do you think that's going to happen?
Oh, my. Look, the United Nations is only as strong as the nations who are members allow it to be, and it often is fairly feeble in terms of what it can do. It can pass resolutions. It doesn't have an army. It doesn't have any way of enforcing the resolution. So I support the UN because there's no alternative. There's nothing stronger that can be done. It's also why I support BDS, because it's a way of having a grassroots movement that is separate from the United Nations and separate from any international body, but it's an amalgamation of people and groups all across the world that want to reaffirm this right of the Palestinians to full and equal rights in Israel, and also the right of return and the right to have Jerusalem as a capital, either of the one country or two, depending on what option they choose.
Okay, Richard, thank you very much indeed. Richard Silverstein, journalist and political commentator, joining us out of Seattle. Now, the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump comes up with yet another move to further consolidate its anti-Palestine stance. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo becomes the first person in his position to pay a visit to an Israeli settlement in the West Bank and the occupied Golan Heights.
Former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden has been projected the winner in the disputed U.S. presidential vote. That means in about 2 months, Donald Trump will have to hand in power to Biden. His administration, however, is using every opportunity to take controversial steps. On Thursday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo paid a visit to an Israeli settlement in the occupied West Bank to further consolidate Israel's occupation of Palestinian lands.
During the Trump administration, America stands with Israel like never before. Indeed, the commitment we've made, the ironclad commitment we've made to the Jewish state, will continue.
Pompeo said the U.S. will label the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign as anti-Semitic and cancerous. He said Washington will require that imports from Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank be labeled as made in Israel. In 2016, the United Nations Security Council adopted a resolution to reaffirm the illegality of Israeli settlements. Referring to Israelis as an occupying power, the resolution called on Israel to stop settlement constructions and abide by its obligations under international law. Later in the day, Mike Pompeo also visited the occupied Golan Heights, which Israel seized from Syria in a 1967 war. President Trump recognized Israel's sovereignty over the region last year. Pompeo's Thursday visits drew the ire of the Palestinians. A spokesman for Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas slammed the U.S. labeling move as a violation of international law. Also, senior member of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Wasil Abu Youssef, said Pompeo's labeling announcement, quote, reaffirms the partnership between U.S. President Trump and the occupation. Another senior PLO member, Hanan Ashrawi, said Mike Pompeo's visit is aimed at setting another illegal precedent. Pompeo's visits to an Israeli settlement and the occupied Golan Heights were controversial enough. However, they are dwarfed by other anti-Palestinian moves taken by the Trump administration in the past 4 years. Trump announced Jerusalem al-Quds as the capital of Israel. Palestinians say the city belongs to them and is the capital of their state. Trump also relocated the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to al-Quds. The American president also showed unprecedented support for Israeli crimes, including bombardment of the Gaza Strip and killing of Palestinians across the occupied territories, setting new precedents in Washington's deep-seated and biased support for the Israeli occupation and crimes against Palestinians.
Staying in the U.S., officials in the state of Georgia say a hand audit of ballots cast in the November 3rd presidential election confirms Joe Biden's victory there. Georgia's Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, said the audit had aligned a further close to what they had in election night reporting. He said there's no doubt that Georgia would certify Biden's victory on Friday. But even after the results are certified, President Donald Trump can request a recount in the battleground state. That's because the margin of Biden's victory is less than 0.5%. On Thursday, Biden slammed as totally irresponsible Trump's challenge of the results of the presidential election.
I think they're witnessing incredible irresponsibility, incredibly damaging messages being sent to the rest of the world about how democracy functions. And I think it is I don't know his motive, but I just think it's totally irresponsible.
Biden criticized the Trump administration's refusal to give his team access to key federal agencies. Biden argued the obstruction is affecting his team's ability to create a plan to respond to the coronavirus pandemic. The former vice president has been projected by mainstream U.S. media as the winner or of the White House race. Trump has rejected the call and declared himself the winner. He has claimed election fraud, launching several lawsuits in a number of states. However, many of those have either been withdrawn or rejected. So there has been dramatic political infighting among the Democratic Party following the electoral failure of their so-called blue wave. The Conservative Party is also in disarray as the major support for Donald Trump and the so-called Trumpian Republicans heralds a major shift. Ramin Mazahari has more from Chicago.
Both mainstream parties in the United States have been profoundly shaken by the election results from November 3rd. While the Democrats may prevail in the still disputed presidential election, their so-called blue wave has been universally described as an abject disaster. Despite unprecedented mainstream media support, widespread leftist-based protests, and record fundraising, they failed to retake the Senate, lost seats in the House, lost one governorship, and failed to flip a single state legislature. Because this is a census year, Republicans will control drawing up most of the decade's new electoral maps, causing many to say the election was a disastrous setback for progressive causes.
70% of Republicans, 90% of Democratic voters are for Medicare for All. They're for the ending of student debt. They're for a UBI to sustain them, especially during COVID. So these things are very progressive, and the Democrats were against them.
Massive infighting among the party elite is being reported. Older and moderate Democrats blame newly popular progressive causes for the losses, but the Democratic Socialists of America, the left wing of the Democratic Party, won 70% of the races and ballot initiatives they endorsed.
The Democrats really aren't progressive. I would attribute the their losses to putting up bad candidates, candidates that are very centrist. So this is the strategy of the Democrats, is we need to be more centrist or more rightist centrist, and they'll blame progressives.
The election results were widely expected to be a repudiation of so-called Trumpism, but analysts say they actually cemented the unprecedented political uprising unexpectedly led by Donald Trump. So-called Trumpian Republicans are now expected to reshape the Conservative Party. There seems to be unanimous agreement that regardless of the final outcome of the presidential election, Trump and his family will have increased, not decreased, control over the Republican Party. A pre-election poll asked Republicans and Republican-leaning independents if they considered themselves a supporter of Trump or a supporter of the Republican Party. 60% picked Trump.
Whichever presidential candidate is finally inaugurated, it seems certain that America has undergone a dramatic political shift, which few people predicted and which many are struggling to understand and accept. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Now, the U.S. reports more than 2,200 new coronavirus deaths in a day, its record high since May, pushing the overall death toll to over 252,000. The world's worst-hit country by the pandemic has also confirmed over 200,000 new infections, which bring the total number of cases to 11.7 million. Meanwhile, in Mexico, the death toll from the respiratory disease surpassed 100,000, making the country the world's fourth nation to hit the milestone. Mexico has also confirmed over 1 million positive cases of COVID-19. Elsewhere in the region, Brazil has confirmed a total of nearly 6 million infection cases and over 168,000 fatalities. The UK's parliamentary spending watchdogs have revealed worrying patterns within the government's spending in the battle against the coronavirus pandemic. Allegations of sleaze and cronyism were often downplayed, but new revelations outline contracts given specifically to Tory party donors and members who've been accused of profiting from the pandemic. Murtaza Jaffar has more in this report.
Referring to the vaccine's task.
A growing sense of anger as revelations of sleaze and cronyism put more shame on the UK government's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. A report by the National Audit Office has revealed a worrying trend. Almost 500 PPE suppliers with direct links to the Conservative Party were fast-tracked to a, quote, high priority channel to supply UK government contracts where they were 10 times more likely to be successful. According to the report, more than half of all government contracts were awarded in this way, without tender, in the first 6 months of the pandemic. A separate legal case playing out in US courts has revealed the government's use of a go-between who secured, quote, lucrative government contracts for PPE. Leader of the opposition, Keir Starmer, asked Boris Johnson to elaborate during Prime Minister's questions.
And whilst the Prime Minister and Chancellor won't pay people enough to isolate properly, we learnt this week that they can find £21 million of taxpayers' money to pay a go-between to deliver a lucrative contract to the Department of Health. £21 million.
Johnson reiterated his pride at securing supply during a global pandemic, but this concern has been highlighted on numerous occasions.
Price of an FFP2 mask bought by the government increased by 1,400% in just 6 weeks to the end of May, and gowns by 350%. I welcome all efforts by the government to procure PPE, but I have concerns that we may not be getting a fair price. One company, PPE MedPro Limited, was given government contracts worth over £190 million. PPE MedPro Limited had no previous experience and coincidentally was only set up on the 12th of May 2020. Reports have suggested that this company has substantial links to Conservative Party donors.
The mainstream media have largely ignored this scandal. However, over the past week, revelations are impossible to ignore. The Good Law Project have been at the forefront of this issue, and have filed a number of lawsuits against the government.
So the National Audit Office has said that even in a time of crisis, there has to be transparency, there has to be a trail of documentation. If the government doesn't produce this swiftly, you're then going to pursue this case in the courts, isn't that right?
Well, we have, as I say, issued a number of separate legal cases. We will be pursuing those cases. There will be hearings in February, and government is now going to have to, under compulsion of the rules of court, produce material that it has so far refused to produce.
These revelations came as the UK recorded another 598 coronavirus deaths in the past 24 hours. The total number of fatalities in the UK is now 52,745, the highest in Europe. The government's handling of the virus has been poor, to say the least, but the growing focus on spending and profiteering will bring a new level of scrutiny for this government.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight. President Donald Trump's campaign has withdrawn a central part of his lawsuit seeking to stop the certification of the election results in Pennsylvania, where Democrat Joe Biden beat Trump to capture the state and help win the White House. Ahead of a Tuesday hearing in the case, Trump's campaign on Sunday, 15th of November, dropped the allegation that 682,479 mail-in and absentee ballots were illegally processed without its representatives watching. The campaign's slimmed-down lawsuit, filed in federal court on Sunday, 15th of November, maintains the aim of blocking Pennsylvania from certifying a victory for Joe Biden in the state, and it maintains its claim that Democratic voters were treated more favorably than Republican voters. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff writers at the Associated Press. The piece is titled, Trump Campaign Abandons Part of Legal Challenge to Pennsylvania Election Results. Stay with us for more of the article by the Associated Press. President Donald Trump's campaign has withdrawn a central part of his lawsuit seeking to stop the certification of the election results in Pennsylvania, where Democrat Joe Biden beat Donald Trump to capture the state and help win the White House. Ahead of a Tuesday hearing in the case, Trump's campaign on Sunday, 15th of November, dropped the allegation that 682,479 mail-in and absentee ballots were illegally processed without its representatives watching. The campaign's slimmed-down lawsuit,
filed in a federal court of law on Sunday, 15th of November, maintains the aim of blocking Pennsylvania from certifying a victory for Joe Biden in the state, and it maintains its claim that Democratic voters were treated more favorably than Republican voters. The Associated Press, on 7th of November, called the presidential contest for former Vice President Joe Biden, after determining that the remaining ballots left to be counted in Pennsylvania would not allow Donald Trump to catch up. Trump has refused to concede. The remaining claim in the lawsuit centers on disqualifying ballots cast by voters who were given an opportunity to fix mail-in ballots that were going to be disqualified on a technicality. The lawsuit charges that Democratic-heavy counties violated the law by identifying mail-in ballots before Election Day that had defects, such as lacking an inner secrecy envelope or lacking a voter's signature on the outside envelope, so that the voter could fix it and ensure their vote would count, a move called curing. Republican-heavy counties followed the law and did not provide a notice and cure process, disenfranchising many, the lawsuit said. Cliff Levine, a lawyer representing the Democratic National Committee, DNC, which is seeking to intervene, said it was not clear how many voters were given the chance to fix their ballot. But he said the number was minimal and certainly fewer than the margin, almost 70,000 votes, that separates Joe Biden and Donald Trump. The numbers aren't even close to the margin between the two candidates, not even close, Levine said. In any case, there is no provision in state law preventing counties from helping voters to fix a ballot that contains a technical deficiency. Cliff Levine said the lawsuit did not contain any allegation that somebody voted illegally. They really should be suing the counties that didn't allow voters to make corrections, Levine said. The goal should be making sure that every vote counts. Pennsylvania's top election official, Secretary of State Kathy Buchvar, a Democrat, responded in court on Sunday, asking the judge to dismiss the case. State courts are the proper jurisdiction for the subject, and the lawsuit contains no plausible claim for relief on any legal theory, the state's lawyer wrote. More than 2.6 million mail-in ballots were reportedly received by counties, and no report of fraud or accuracy problems have been made by state or county election officials or prosecutors. A key theme of Donald Trump and his supporters has been their claim that Philadelphia, a Democratic bastion where Donald Trump lost badly, had not allowed Trump's campaign representatives to watch mail-in and absentee ballots processed and tabulated. However, Republican lawyers have acknowledged in a separate federal court proceeding that they had certified observers watching mail-in ballots being processed in Philadelphia. Philadelphia's governor, Tom Wolf's administration, has said that ballot watchers from all parties had observers throughout the process, and that any insinuation otherwise is a lie. Meanwhile, the White House is coming under growing pressure from President-elect Joe Biden, as well as senior Republicans and health experts, to allow transition talks to begin amid a terrifying surge in coronavirus cases that is pushing hospital systems across the United States to the brink of collapse. As President Donald Trump insisted he would not concede defeat, despite tweeting that Biden won last week's election, Ron Klein, Joe Biden's chief of staff, said on Sunday it was essential that a seamless transition begins quickly, given the severity of the coronavirus pandemic. Ron Klain told NBC's Meet the Press, Biden's COVID advisory panel remains hamstrung from talking to U.S. government health officials, including the White House task force led by Vice President Mike Pence. Under transition rules routinely followed for the past 60 years, a letter of ascertainment declaring Biden the winner of the 3rd November election should by now have been issued by the General Services Administration, GSA, authorizing communication between the outgoing and incoming administrations. But with Donald Trump still refusing to concede, as he lies repeatedly on Twitter about a stolen election, no such letter has been produced. Unfortunately, until we get the General Services Administration GSA ascertainment letter that authorizes us to contact government officials, we can't have any contacts, Ron Klain said.
Are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ministry.
Ahead of the election, the U.S. presidential candidates were vocal on important foreign policy issues in the Middle East, including Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Palestine. But debate was visibly absent on one critical issue, Iraq. It remains unclear the kind of approach the new U.S. administration will adopt in the Middle East, and more particularly on Iraq. But President-elect Joe Biden has a long history of involvement in the oil-rich country, with a controversial track record since the early 2000s. And so, while Iraqi leaders, including Iraqi President Barham Saleh and Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi, congratulated Joe Biden soon after the announcement of his victory, Baghdad remains cautious of the relations ahead. As chair of the U.S. Senate in 2002, Biden voted for a resolution that led to the U.S. invasion of Iraq a year later. He also served as vice president to Obama, playing a key role in the drawdown of 150,000 American troops from the country in 2011. Although many supported the move at the time, it was intentional to create a security vacuum that paved the way for the rise of Daesh. By 2014, the Takfiri group occupied large swaths of Iraqi territory, a development that, surprise, surprise, brought U.S. occupation forces back to the country as part of an international coalition to supposedly fight Daesh. However, Biden is mostly known for co-authoring a controversial 2006 article that called for the division of Iraq along ethnic and religious lines. Seen as a plan to divide and further deepen sectarian divisions in Iraq, the proposal was badly received in Baghdad. This makes us wonder how Baghdad will receive it again when Biden is sworn in as president and ready to implement his plan of dividing Iraq. It would also mean active involvement of U.S. occupation troops in facilitating the new U.S. plan to divide the country. However, it's 2020, not 2006 anymore. Iraq's popular mobilization units Hashd-e Shaabi have made it clear that in the event the U.S. defies Iraqi law by extending its illegal stay, then the Hashd-e Shaabi will have no other option but to confront the force of occupation. Welcome to the Mideast Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Iraq did not feature in the U.S. 2020 election campaign, but is likely to be a permanent file on Joe Biden's desk. Biden backed the U.S. invasion in 2003 before changing his mind. Now, as vice president to Barack Obama, he was involved in the decision to withdraw U.S. forces from Iraq, which he saw as an opportunity to atone from his earlier mistake. However, Biden had proposed a plan in 2006 to divide Iraq into three Shia, Sunni, and Kurdish regions, believing that this would allow U.S. forces to leave Iraq by 2008. This time, he plans to make it happen. To discuss with us this issue from Beirut is Mr. Laith Maruf, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Laith. Now, the Iraqi file has been stressing nearly all U.S. presidents for years now. Biden has visited Iraq more than 27 times and is familiar with the contents of the file as well as the Iraqi politicians. Now, on what grounds does he really think that dividing Iraq according to sectarian and religious lines would actually help the country rather than just weaken it more?
Well, he doesn't really care about helping the country. What he cares about is American supremacy in the region, and that can only be achieved by breaking up the national states in the Arabic world into fractured mini-states that are constantly at war with each other around ethnic and religious or sectarian lines. So this is not a new plan. This has been the plan since before World War I in terms of breaking up the old Ottoman domain into those fractured identities that cannot coagulate together to form a state that can be sovereign or independent of Western imperialism. And it will continue, this plan. This is the only way that the West can guarantee its control of the region.
Well, Laith, Biden must truly understand that Iraq today is different from the Iraq that he knew, especially the one where he decided to present a platform or a plan in the U.S. to divide the country into three semi-autonomous regions. America itself is at a defining moment in Iraq, controlling no territory or very specific territory, having no influence or unable even to intervene in political decision-making process. They are regularly being threatened by the popular mobilization units for a confrontation, especially in the event that the U.S. does not actually abide by the withdrawal timetable set by the Iraqi parliament for them to leave the country. How do you see the Iraqi factions reacting to Biden's plan if he really has it in mind to be implemented in Iraq?
Well, the last time the United States attempted to do that with the referendum in Iraq, Kurdistan province, we saw the response, the immediate response from the government of Iraq, from the factions in Iraq, and even from the government of Iran and Turkey. Within hours of that referendum, all the entrances and exits to Kurdistan were, you know, taken over by the Iraqi army and the Iranian army, and that ended it, that possibility of separation. So the West can dream as much as they want of fracturing Arab societies and countries further, but that plan is gone, long gone. The power to do so that may have existed around World War I, even maybe after the end of the Soviet Union, is gone now. The United States has burnt all its cards, all its games have been played out and didn't work out, and everybody knows these plots and plans by heart. Everybody has memorized what the United States is trying to do, and it's not going to work out.
So you think Biden might actually have another option on the table here?
Well, the option that we see the United States in general, whether it's Biden or Trump in power, is confrontation with Iran. They've tried to fracture the Iraqi society since the 1990s, mm-hmm. and it didn't work out. They tried invading, defeating Hezbollah in Lebanon, and it didn't work out. They tried invading and fracturing Syria, and it didn't work out. So now the only thing that they have in front of them is to have a confrontation with Iran, which is also not going to work out.
Well, from what you just said, one of the game changers in Iraq that Biden is actually hoping for to reach is a new agreement with Iran, where one of the concessions will be for Iran to reduce its influence in Iraq, meaning to stop its support to the Popular Mobilization Forces, the only viable force against ISIS, which was able to defeat ISIS in Iraq, and help also the Syrian Arab Army on the border to rid both countries from these terrorists, these Western-backed terrorists, if I may. But come on now, I mean, he would seriously ask them that. The Iranians, I mean, especially after Donald Trump assassinated one of the most important men in Iran, Lieutenant General Martyr Qasem Soleimani, at the beginning of 2020?
It's wishful thinking to think that you can ask Iran to give up on its principled position of support for Palestinian liberation, for Arab sovereignty, for Muslim unity, in return for a few dollars in trade. You know, they've asked that to the smaller factions of the resistance accents. We've seen them try to do that with Hezbollah, and, you know, Hezbollah refusing to give up its principle. We've seen how Syria was, you know, offered the moon and the stars and the sun by the imperialists if they give up on Palestine, on the resistance in Lebanon, and in their relationship with Iran. And 10 years of war on Syria, still Syria refuses to give up on its principles. So it is wishful thinking to think that Iran will give up on the principles of justice, equality, and liberation for a few measly dollars.
Well, it's also very important to talk about the factor that is always being pushed away by the U.S., which is the Popular Mobilization Forces and the threats that they have been issuing against the U.S. occupation troops in Iraq especially for the past 2 months. I mean, they are constantly threatening them not to play games with the Iraqi decision to withdraw their troops from Iraq. Do you think we are maybe moving closer towards a full-fledged confrontation with the U.S. Army, between the U.S. Army and the Iraqi PMU when Biden takes office? In the meantime, there are people who are saying it's going to happen even earlier than that, when even Trump is still there.
This is now a very dangerous time frame that we have from now till inauguration in the early January of the president, whichever president comes in. We know that
they're not sure if it's Biden or Trump.
He's very unsure. You know, maybe Trump is going to bring in the army on the streets and stay in power. But to come back to the issue of Iraq, you know, we've seen how the Pentagon and hierarchy within the American military were basically lying to Trump about the numbers of troops in Syria. They've lied to him about withdrawals. And what does that tell you? That tells you that no matter who is the president of the United States, the deep state that controls the actual decisions is the one that makes the shots. So it doesn't matter what Biden wants. It doesn't matter what Trump wants.
It's the real president, the Pentagon and the CIA.
Exactly. So the deep state, the military complex, the imperialist power of America speaks above and beyond any president.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Laith Maluf, political commentator, for talking to us about the possibility of an actual confrontation between the forces, the legal forces in Iraq, the Popular Mobilization Forces, and the U.S. occupation troops in the event they don't leave and in the event Biden decides to divide Iraq. I want to thank you very much for your contribution. Now, please stay tuned. We will talk next about Syria and the sanctions that are preventing refugees to return to their country. Stay with us.
Syrian President Bashar Assad declared last week that the Syrian government is working to secure the return of millions of refugees who fled war in their country. But Western sanctions are hindering the work of state institutions, hence complicating those plans. President Assad said millions of refugees were being forced to stay in host countries by pressure or intimidation, and that host states were enticing them financially while benefiting from international aid on their behalf. West preventing refugees from returning to Syria in this following report. Syrian President Bashar Assad announced last week that the Syrian government is working to secure the return of millions of refugees who fled war in their country. But Western sanctions are hindering the work of state institutions and complicating those plans. President Assad's comments came at the opening session of a two-day international conference in Damascus on the return of refugees. The event was boycotted by many Western countries who blatantly say the time is not ripe yet for the return of refugees. They insist the first priority should be to make it safe for people to go back to the war-torn country. These Western countries that have been funding extremism in Syria since 2011 seem to have forgotten that the Syrian Arab Army have recaptured much of Syria from their proxy terrorists, with the backing of other allies like Russia and Iran, which helped rid the country from complete chaos. Neighboring Turkey, a main backer of proxy Takfiri armed groups in Syria, was not invited to the conference. Another neighbor, Jordan, which also hosts Syrian refugees, did not participate. Lebanon's outgoing foreign minister, Sherb El-Wehbi, addressed the gathering by video conference and used the opportunity to call on the international community to help in the return of Syrian refugees. Lebanon is hosting the highest per capita number of Syrian refugees, who at one point made up nearly a quarter of the tiny country's population of 5 million. The country is now mired in an unprecedented economic and financial crisis. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, whose speech was read by the Russian President's envoy to Syria, described the sanctions as financial strangulation used to prevent the arrival of foreign aid and put up obstacles to prevent the return of the displaced to areas under government control. President Assad emphasized during his speech that the European and U.S. sanctions on his government hinder rebuilding efforts and improvement of infrastructure that was damaged by the war, which doesn't help the return of refugees. Now with us from Damascus to discuss the issue of Western countries not allowing refugees to go back to their country is Vanessa Bailey, independent journalist and photographer. Thank you for being with us, Vanessa. Now, over the past few years, Syria has succeeded in achieving the return of hundreds of thousands of refugees back home, and the government is still working relentlessly for the return of each refugee who is willing to participate in rebuilding his country. However, some regional and Western countries are impeding their return home, with more than 70% of Syria now free and safe for their return. It's free from the terrorism that the West already harbored. Why would those countries hinder the return of the Syrian refugees home?
Well, I think because to a large degree that would mean normalization of their relationships with Syria. Of course, they basically want to maintain the propaganda, which of course manufactures consent for the so-called humanitarian war against Syria. And therefore, to see from a propaganda point of view, to see refugees returning home in their droves is not acceptable to the US coalition, to the US alliance, which of course is also backed heavily, and the intelligence operations are backed heavily by the UK. So the last thing they want to see are these refugees going back to Syria, because that would also mean that to a large degree they had to accept their defeat, both from a military perspective but also from an information war perspective.
Well, we did hear Syrian President Bashar Assad blaming the United States of America for hampering the return of refugees to Syria, citing the continuous U.S. sanctions as one of the main hurdles in doing so. Can you explain how the U.S. sanctions actually intimidate Syrian refugees from returning home to help rebuild the country?
Well, I think if we consider the sanctions to be part of the U.S. hybrid war strategy, which of course has been part of the war waged against Syria from 2011, and this includes not only the sanction regime, which of course was increased to an even more sadistic level with the imposition of the seizure law sanctions earlier this year based on the fraudulent reports commissioned by Qatar. Qatar, of course, is one of the major backers and sponsors of the terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda inside Syria. And so not only economically are things being made very, very difficult for people to return, but of course we've seen this year the burning of crops both by Israel and by America, by the American troops, by the American proxies, the burning of plantations, the burning of olive groves, the burning of cotton plantations deliberately by possible affiliates of the armed groups. And of course the armed groups are the proxies of the US coalition inside Syria. We've seen the occupation, the ongoing occupation of the oil fields, which of course is, it's not so much the revenue that's coming in from those oil fields, it's the prevention of the oil reaching the Syrian civilians. And that of course is increasing the electricity problems, the fuel problems, the gas and essential infrastructure problems. So it's not only sanctions. It's an entire raft of measures and strategies by the US coalition to keep Syria in this insecure state.
No worries. Actually, I love your dogs and I appreciate them having the time to be along with us. No worries at all. But while the U.S. relations with Iran, Turkey, and Russia, and obviously the Israeli regime could all have reverberations in Syria, Biden seems unlikely to expend political capital there as per his position on the war on Syria. Does this maybe signal some sort of a possible change of attitude towards the Syrian government that the U.S. administration during both the Obama and the Trump administration had against the government in Syria and the Syrian president?
I think the problem is with Biden is that you're going back to almost default position. You're going back to an Obama position. If you look at the proposed administration of Biden, you have some of the most historically aggressive war hawks in his administration. You have what is effectively a bipartisan war party under Biden. With a clear ambition to destroy Russia, to destroy Chinese, as they say, expansionism. And therefore, of course, Syria will be caught in those crosshairs. You have Biden effectively putting out statements that he wants the U.S. military to be the greatest force again in the world. You have him, of course, demanding the strengthening of NATO. So you have someone now in power, and I don't even consider Biden to be the real power. Of course, who I consider to be the power are those behind the election of Biden. And those include Dick Cheney, John Negroponte, of course, who was instrumental in leading the war against Iraq in 2003 based on the weapons of mass destruction. So you have effectively a transversal war party under Biden, and unfortunately, I think that signals potential greater military intervention in Syria on the basis of pushing back against, you know, as part of the Cold War strategy against Russia and against Chinese expansionism.
You see, Vanessa, the observers of the Syrian domestic politics have noted that Trump's Syria policy had actually succeeded in turning President Assad's triumph into an actual disaster, ensuring that Syria remained rested by stopping the funds the Syrian government needed for reconstruction after huge swaths of the country's infrastructure had been destroyed because of the war that was backed by the West against Syria. Now, where are the options left here for the Syrian government to try and reboot the country's economy and mainly just begin the process of reconstruction here?
I think while I agree that Trump has been far from, let's say, sympathetic to the Syrian cause, I think when you compare Trump and Biden, you're not comparing the same people. Trump didn't, but one wonders to what extent the influence for his actions on that has come from the deep state that, of course, are now pushing Biden into position. But I think all that Syria can do, which is what it has been doing, is, if you like, to pivot towards Russia, towards Iran, and towards China, and to use the countries that are prepared to trade with Syria to circumvent the sanctions, like, for example, Venezuela, Cuba, even South Africa. The South African embassy has remained open in Syria during the entire conflict. And we know that South Africa itself, or the ambassador here, is trying to further economic relations between South Africa and Syria and to open up business opportunities here. So we, you know, Syria has to recognize its true allies and to work with those, as I said, who are also all suffering from American sanctions, mm-hmm. And to create an environment in which trade can be participated in by those nations, by those non-aligned nations, in order to squeeze out the American supremacists, because that's effectively what it is. Of course, it's an economic hegemony that America is trying to maintain, and that Biden, for certain, will continue to try to maintain. So I don't think we should see it as a Trump policy or an Obama policy or a Biden policy. It's mm-hmm. a deep state policy. It's a U.S. policy, and it will be maintained by whoever the president is, incoming or outgoing.
I want to thank you very much, Vanessa Bealey, independent journalist and photographer, for joining us from Damascus to talk about how the West is actually hindering the return of Syrian refugees back to their hometown, back to their homeland in Syria, to try and rebuild the country. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you. And please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
In the limelight.